The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, welcome back to yet another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. For those of you who have never heard this show before and have listened to it before, I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. I am a Russian Orthodox nationalist historian specializing in Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy and the Anglo-Orthodox liturgy of Saint Ikon, and we've dealt with the Western Rite and the significance of the Western Rite in the Orthodox Church on this program before, and we will get into it, no doubt, even in more detail in the future. I am not of Russian background. I am Russian Orthodox, however, and that is it's the Church and its leadership. The Church is de facto led by Russia only because of her size and population and military capability. And although I'm not of Russian background, but that's not an issue, because if you say that you're Roman Catholic, it doesn't mean you're Italian. It simply means that you are loyal to this particular tradition, and for better or for worse, that understanding of God and creation. The nationalism that I have promoted on this show is really centered around the Romantic and National Romantic movement of the 19th and early 20th century. We've dealt with that on this show in Herder in the National Romantics. And it's the sort of nationalism that is based on culture and religion and ethnicity rather than the state or the more artificial kinds of nations that are in fact created by the state. The state is a mini empire. It uses the ethnic tradition to destroy the legitimate ethnic and religious diversity of any particular population. A serious, humane, and morally defensible form of nationalism is the one that was promoted by Johann Herder and his followers in the Romantic school at the turn of the 19th, and then again the National Romantic movement, the turn of the 20th century. So this is about culture, tradition, and our relationship to God, not the state, not the army, not these more belligerent elements of nationalism. And as a result, we are as much interested in the self-determination of Ukraine, Carpathorus, Belarus, and even the diversity within them, such as the Lemka and other groups, to have as much independence within a brotherly relationship as possible. And this was the program of the Ukrainians, people like Shevchenko and Drahomanov in the Brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius. We've also dealt with that on this show. So it is not a belligerent or chauvinistic kind of nationalism, which in fact is identical with imperialism, simply because basic morality would forbid us to hold the view that nationalism is good for me, but not for you. That really is at the center of the Jewish and Zionist mentality that says they and only they may be nationalist and cohesive. Everyone else has to be liberal. Liberalism is essentially Judaism for the rest of the world. A firm kind of ethnic solidarity is Judaism for the insiders. So, to be morally consistent and to oppose this kind of Zionist mentality, we hold to a view of nationalism that accepts the ethnic group and those who identify with it as the central actors in global politics and global history, and that the state, to the extent that it's relevant at all, the state needs to follow ethnic lines and ethnic majorities wherever they can be found, and also, of course, to protect the interests of minorities and make sure that they're able to live an autonomous existence in one form or another. Now, you have a lot of Russian nationalists who want to deny the Belarusian or Ukrainian nationality, and that is simply incorrect. They are separate cultures and separate peoples. They should have independent states and independent churches done in their native language. However, that certainly does not mean that they should be somehow opponents, and it's outrageous that you have Ukrainian leaders like the phony KGB Patriarch of Kiev, so-called Patriarch of Kiev, Filaret, whose entire world revolves around his anger, negative emotions of not being elected Patriarch of Moscow when he was in the KGB, and so he decided to become a Ukrainian nationalist and hates everything Russian. This is absurd. This is typical political garbage. Yes, they are two separate peoples. They should have two separate churches. They have separate languages, and they have separate approaches to the world. I think that's been proven time and again, no different than the southern U.S., and many other regional distinctions in the world's nations. They should be separate. They should be brotherly, approaching each other as equals on the world stage, maintaining some kind of solidarity one with another. And that was the point of view of Nikolai Gogol, and we've also dealt with that in some detail on this show. I got an email probably the beginning of the year, and I kind of forgot about it. And a listener had asked me to describe how it is that I got into this field. I'm mostly of Irish extraction. I have some Hungarian in me from my mother's side. That Hungarian actually comes from Carpatho Rus, because my mother's family ultimately is from Uzhhorod. But they were ethnic Hungarians and Roman Catholics. And one of my favorite stories to tell people is back in graduate school when I decided to convert to the Orthodox Church. My mother said, I don't understand why you would want to convert to the religion of our serfs. And that's kind of just a tongue-in-cheek way of understanding how the Hungarians viewed the Slavs in their general environment, especially during the time of the Austrian Empire. But I got into this in graduate school, both in St. Louis and in Lincoln. I was studying the history of political philosophy. That was my primary area of graduate concentration in those years. But several things happened. Number one, I began to question the idea that political ideas, metaphysical ideas, simply come from nothing. They don't. They come from actual functioning day-to-day life of living societies. The minimum form of unity for those societies is uniformity in language. And so it didn't take long for me to realize that political philosophy only makes sense if it's connected to the actual traditional life and problems and issues of living societies, unified by language and basic historical consciousness, which is just another way of saying ethnicity. The political demands of a Russian are going to be very different than the political demands for somebody living in Sri Lanka or Indonesia. It just depends on circumstances. What are the big issues? What are the big problems? What is their economic position? What is their topography like? What are their natural resources like? That's going to dictate a lot about how they develop as a people. The second thing that happened is that when I was in Lincoln, I came into Orthodoxy under the Ukrainians, and there was also a Russian parish in Lincoln as well, and actually I went to both. So I got both sides of the equation, and they were all largely immigrant parishes, although that's no longer the case, but it was back then. And I was very much taken in by the Ukrainians. In Lincoln, Nebraska, there were about, at the time, there were about 20 families. In Omaha, an hour away, it was about maybe 30 families. So it was a small diaspora, but very cohesive. And because a lot of their children had abandoned them, they wanted to become Americans and, you know, move to the city and, you know, this kind of crap. And there's some Irishman who shows up out of nowhere. They took me in very much as a substitute for their own children who had left them and who decided this was all just old world nonsense and we're Americans now and so we have no identity and so we'll watch TV and we'll go to work 100 hours a week and we'll be good Americans that way and let the old people have their old world tradition. Well, I went the opposite direction. The old world tradition was correct. The American dream was incorrect. And so they realized that very quickly and took me in. I learned a lot of the language from them. I learned how to cook the way they cook, the basic attitude, and they very much became my second family, both the Ukrainians as well as the Russians in downtown. So that's how all this happened. So a whole bunch of things had converged where I began to question the whole idea of a separate discipline of political philosophy, because I realized that political philosophy actually derives from experience. And so I ended up doing my doctoral dissertation on Michael Oakeshott's critique of ideology, in the sense that ideology does not come from nothing. It comes from the lived experience of a people unified by various important variables like language and common suffering and that sort of thing. At the same time that I'm questioning this, and I'm following this path, I am sort of accepted into the universe of the Ukrainian and Russian diaspora in Lincoln, living among them, learning from them, spending a lot more time with them than, you know, who suffered through World War II, who were in the displaced persons camps, et cetera, than with the university professors who were simply alienated and conformist in their political point of view. I saw real tradition that had gone through and survived the furnace of suffering at the end of the war. And most of these people now are dead and gone, unfortunately. There are a couple still alive that I stay in contact with. But that's the method. That's sort of the history of how I got into this subject. And when I got my first job out of grad school, I had taught at Nebraska for a few years as a graduate student. And then my first job was writing, a staff writer, both for the Spotlight and for the Barnes Review in Washington, D.C. And that was my first job out of grad school. And so, you know, Willis Cardo and these other people gave me the opportunity to expand on this, you know, very interesting and worthwhile approach, both to the historicity of political ideas on the one hand, and the Slavic and Orthodox ethnic tradition on the other. Slowly but surely they came together, and that coming together is in fact my own personal identity, my sense of self, my religious and aesthetic point of view, not to mention, of course, my professional area of expertise. And by 2000, I graduated in 99. By 2000, Vladimir Putin had taken over in Russia, had become immensely popular, and I began to notice his rather vehement stand against the New World Order, against Western imperialism and capitalism, and against Zionism. And he's made that very clearly the central part of his political idea. And so, needless to say, all of this began to dovetail with my vehement opposition to the New World Order and all that it represents in terms of the creation of a global plantation, which is really the ultimate goal of the New World Order. So Russia became for me, from a political point of view as well as from a religious point of view, the center of the world and the center of world politics. Okay, what I wanted to deal with today, I want to deal with two people. I want to deal with two people who, one of whom is a religious philosopher, the other a very well-known novelist. But But I want to deal with both of them as philosophers. The first is Vladimir Ir, who is at least partially of German background. He died at a very young age, 35 years old, in 1917. And he dealt largely with the concept of the Logos doctrine relative to Orthodoxy. And we've dealt with that on this show before, but we're going to deal with Vladimir Ir in particular today. And then the political philosophy of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who some of us probably should have dealt with a long time ago, but I want to deal with Solzhenitsyn not so much as a novelist, but as a political writer and as a political philosopher. So, going in chronological order, we'll start with Vladimir Ir, who was an academic. He was of Russian Orthodox background, but not Russian in terms of his ethnicity. And he viewed European politics primarily as a clash between Enlightenment rationalism and Russian Logos doctrine, or the Greco-Russian Logos doctrine. And he, like a lot of the Slavophiles, he starts from the point of view that you can't escape your cultural context when you're thinking about the world. Our views of things are necessarily colored and filtered by our cultural context. And that for him, the German and the British Enlightenment rationalist point of view was abstract, it was one-sided, and it filtered everything that wasn't quantitative out of the world. And the Russian goal, and this is something you see in Solzhenitsyn as well as Dostoevsky, is not so much the negation of rationalism, but bringing the concept of rationalism to higher levels of synthesis and bringing both quality and quantity together into a final unity. Now, the Russian mind, according to Ir, is based around, intellectually speaking, and remember, he's writing before World War I, is that nature of truth is actually contained in being as logos. Truth is truth because it is connected with how the world actually runs. And the natural laws that govern the natural world are of divine origin. They had to have existed prior to creation, or else they couldn't function. They certainly can't be the subject of development, since they presuppose that development. Or I should say, development presupposes natural law, therefore it must come before any kind of evolutionary development. But these natural laws are of divine origin, and a true statement is true only to the extent that it partakes of this natural law. So with Aaron, you see a lot of connection with Skovoroda, who we've dealt with on the show in some detail, and the negative expression of that is being opposed to any view of the world that is purely mechanistic. The world, the human being, human society, seen as a great machine. Nothing can be more incorrect than that. And empiricism is very naive, because it takes objects in total isolation from their relations. But nothing, including God himself, can be removed from this set of relations. God is a Trinity, which derives from the Father's nature, the universe and the cosmos also exists as a series of relationships, not objects taking out of their context. He sees, in the beginning of the 20th century, modernity coming apart. Modernity suffered in World War I and World War II, where all of the promises of the Enlightenment were shown to be absolute frauds, as tens of millions of Europeans and others were murdered. There is no such thing as human autonomy. Human autonomy is selfishness and egocentrism. We are the products of society, and therefore we owe certain things to the society which helped create us. Our language, our jobs, our professional life, all of these existed long before we ever came into existence, and they helped shape us. In fact, they exclusively shaped us. We can affect them as individuals only a little bit. So the point is, the individual is really a false category. And he traces this, like a lot of the anti-rationalists in the Romantic movement, he traces this to René Descartes. And the central concept of the cogito, or the cogito, the idea of the I think, therefore I exist, as this absolute certain truth. If I think, then by definition I must exist, because non-existence cannot think. The problem with this approach to philosophy, according to Aaron, is that it trapped the West forever in this solipsistic egocentrism. The individual being the only basis of certainty in René Descartes' system and the development of rationalism in the very early Enlightenment, it forever trapped the Western man in these egocentric categories. And Heidegger as well was extremely worried about what this meant for Western development. So when these people are opposed to the West, what they mean specifically is that they are opposed to the Western Enlightenment. Not so much the Middle Ages, not so much the Classical period, but the Enlightenment. The problem for Aaron is that there is no starting point for thought. When we begin to think, we're already in a very complex context. There is no abstract starting point. You cannot start from the ego, because the ego is in fact a social creation. You can't start from the society, because we are in fact a separate person with our own personal interests. None of these, however, can be used as a starting point. None of these can be the absolute center point of any kind of social theory or epistemology. And most of all, if you want to reduce humanity, nature, society to the status of this great machine, then a machine isn't free. A machine is completely determined and controlled by others who have put it together, who maintain it. And so if you accept the Enlightenment idea that nature is a mechanism, then you must reject freedom. You must reject morality and virtue as such. Logos is the organic model, not the mechanistic model of society. It is a qualitative approach to the world. It is dynamic. There is only so much that our language can contain, that our thought can contain. The logos, the source of all creation, all natural law, this is far greater and more complex than any mechanistic understanding or anything that our language can ever promote or represent. Okay, let's stop there for now. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we're going to finish up the basic theory of Aaron and get into, in some detail, the basic social philosophy of Solzhenitsyn, which in some respects does come from this basic mentality.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're talking about Russian philosophy again. We're dealing with Vladimir Aaron and Alexander Solzhenitsyn, both not so much as fiction writers, but as philosophers. What we're trying to say, the mentality, the orthodox mentality of Aaron, is our approach to the world can begin from one of two points of view. The first is the nominalist point of view. The other is the symbolist point of view. We've dealt, actually some time ago, with symbolism on this show. And the basic concept of it is that a symbol does not stand in for something. It is an introduction to something. A symbol is what we see, an impression of what we might sense, that gives us a very small hint of the depth of the actual reality. So, for example, any scientific truth that we may come across is just the beginning. Scientific truth is a purely quantitative entity talking about relations among various forces. But that's just the very first statement of a far deeper comprehension as to the source and purpose of these laws and how these laws are to be somehow internalized in our own life. But the logos is also a social idea. It's about the person as an aspect of the social whole. The individual by himself cannot exist by himself. The individual only becomes an individual because he is born and raised and nurtured within a cultural society. Now, of course, our modern American or Western European society does not do this. It distorts and destroys, especially boys, in how they are raised. But in more healthy societies, in the kind of medieval and royalist and agrarian societies of the past, children are born and raised within a very cohesive social, cultural, and religious system. Therefore, your virtues, your abilities, are not yours. They have, in fact, come from these institutions and people who raised you, the people who died so you could be raised this way, the wars and the sufferings that your people have gone through so you can have the life that you have, for better or for worse. As an individual, you don't matter very much. And that's a simple fact, as unpleasant as it is. So, Logos doctrine strongly suggests that we are part of a social whole, but that's no different, you know, for a human being as it is for anybody else or anything else. Everything exists in context. And so the alternative to that is really the official ideology of the modern Enlightenment, and that is nominalism. Nominalism, in my opinion, is the root of all evil in the Western or in the Eastern world. Nominalism holds, among many other things, that there is no necessary connection between objects and space and time. The only things that exist are individuals abstracted from their context, or even worse than that, the sense impressions that we get from these objects. They don't have any inherent definition or any inherent purpose. We, that is to say, the elite in any given society, give them names, and those names are arbitrary. And so, of course, you know, nominalism means based on names. And that's all they are words, which strongly suggests that we can construct and destruct reality by manipulating language. And if you know anything about advertising or the media, you know how this is done on a regular basis. So, nominalism is the polar opposite of symbolism. For someone like Aaron, and to a great extent, also Nietzsche, this is the choice that the Western world has to make. For Aaron, and to a lesser extent, Solzhenitsyn, although to a great extent, Dostoevsky, Russia's role in world history is to create a philosophical synthesis between those two ideas. Individual, social whole, the nominal object, the symbol. This project was violently disrupted by the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, this is significant because Solzhenitsyn says, and he says this over and over again in those particular works and speeches that are of a political and philosophical argument, that nominalism is a great evil because it took over the West and it enshrined the ego or the individual as the only basis of society. Now, of course, those who reject this idea realize that the family is the basis of society. The ethnic unity, the worship of God, our relationship with nature, this is the basis, not the individual ego. And that the West has taken it to such an extent where man as ego is worshipped as a deity. And actually, as that turns out in real life, as, for example, as C.S. Lewis had said, the way that that turns out to function in real life is that we end up worshipping celebrities, people with money and power, people who are basically media creations rather than actual people. It's the worship of man, it's the worship of the individual, the worship of the ego, the worship of dead matter. The purpose of life, apparently, is to satisfy this ego. The problem is that automatically entails that those with more money and more power can do a much better job satisfying their ego than me or you can. And if we don't like that idea, we have no place to stand. We have no right to judge, because everyone is supposed to follow their ego and their desire as much as humanly possible. And therefore, if someone happens to be far wealthier than we are and can dominate us because of that, we have no place to stand to criticize them, because they're doing nothing more than we are. We're pursuing our ego in our way, they're doing it in their way. If it so happens that they have more money and more power, that's just how it works. But this is the very basis of Western social life. It's the basis of liberalism, it's the basis of libertarianism, it's the basis of much conservatism. And the real problem with World War II was that the two victors were the liberal, individualistic statist West on the one hand, and the Marxist statist Soviet Empire on the other hand. That's who won. Any other concept of the organic unity of the people, that suddenly was eliminated as oppressive. And the Soviet system and the liberal system began trading very briskly and divided up the world between them without any concern for anyone else but themselves. And the fact is, and Solzhenitsyn has said this over and over again, I've said this over and over again, capitalism and communism are the same point of view. Capitalism and communism both are about the maximization of production and the centralized decision-making apparatus that decides how the economy is going to be run. Whether or not these elites are owners of capital, or whether the state is the owner of capital, ultimately it turns out in the same way. The big difference is, of course, the U.S. decided that it was going to promote the consumer goods market, where the Soviet Union wanted to support the heavy industry as the basis of what later will become, of course never occurred, the consumer goods market. So in the West, it was the powerful individual who decided. In the East, it was a state controlled by a handful of powerful individuals who decided. Ultimately, these are all based on production and domination of nature, the domination of the individual, elite control, materialism, production for production's sake. Ultimately, the two systems are identical. The British Empire, which was supposed to be this liberal capitalist empire, functioned in places like South Africa and Ireland far harsher than the Soviet Union treated its own dissidents. There were concentration camps in the Soviet Union. There were concentration camps in South Africa, controlled by the British prior to the Boer War. There was extermination and genocide in the Soviet Union. The British practiced the exact same thing in Ireland. There is no reason why a liberal democratic empire cannot treat people the same way that the Soviets treated their people. There's no distinction. The fact is that when you look at world history, whether the Soviet Empire based in Moscow or the British Empire based in the Rothschild family in London, their treatment of their subject people was exactly the same. And the great tragedy in Solzhenitsyn's mind is that the Bolshevik Revolution totally westernized Russian society and made it a part of the Western world, and it took all of the vices without any of the virtues of Western nominalism and empiricism and this worship of the machine. When you view the world as this great machine, you see this in Aaron and in Solzhenitsyn, then everything becomes a political issue. Every problem can be solved with just a little bit more money. The bureaucracy needs a little bit more power. You need to pay a little bit more in tax dollars. A couple of wars. Eliminate your opposition. And everything should be okay. If you view society as a machine, then you need to have a group of elites outside of that machine who know how to tinker with it and who know how to fix it. Therefore, everything becomes a political issue. Everything becomes a matter of state power. Everything becomes a matter of control. So Solzhenitsyn looks at this. He sees it in the USSR. He sees it in the British Empire. He sees it in the United States and her empire. Says there is no discussion, however, of what's really needed, and that is internal reform. Not everything is a political issue. Not everything can be solved by political means. Politics, the state, money, the machine, economics, all of these are significant, but they have their limits. The best political or economic system will fail if the people don't have the virtue to use that properly or to live within that properly. Virtue has to come first. A virtuous population can live and be happy under any government. A vicious population cannot thrive under the best of governments or economic systems. All of this leads to Solzhenitsyn's critique of political parties. This is typical of the kind of the anti-rationalist way of thinking. Even the American founding fathers in the Federalist Party, regardless of the fact that party had already formed even before the revolution, hated the idea of parties because it meant that society was fundamentally divided. And as we see today, 2011, in Russia and in Ukraine, political parties are really either the creation of Washington, D.C., or the vehicle for elite oligarchs and their interests. They certainly don't represent, at any level really, the population of these countries. There are smaller parties that do have an idealistic approach, and we will deal with that on this show. But the way that democracy has worked in Western Europe and America, those with money and power are capable of forming parties, of creating social movements, of using or controlling the media, and deciding what money goes where, and therefore which candidates get to be promoted and which get forgotten. Modernity has created a divided society based on class and other forms of interest. And if that's the case, and if there is this intrinsic division in society, then even using the word society is false. There can be no trust. There can be no unity. Man, in his fallen state, is evil. Man, generally speaking, men and women, care about themselves, their interests, and what society can give them. Parties, politicians are no different. They're self-seeking, controlled by big money. Americans have no right to condemn their government for running up a debt when the consumer credit card debt is far higher than the federal government's debt. Society, in Solzhenitsyn's mind, should be removed from politics. It should function according to its own interests and variables at the local level. And whatever has worked, whatever has developed that creates peace, that creates harmony, that creates unity and solidarity, that should be the basis of local society. States are based on control and manipulation. Marxism, of course, is a Western creation. Marxism is, I mean, its devotees from Marx on down viewed themselves as the true sons of the Enlightenment. These are the people who said, we finally, if the Marxist system is implemented, the promises of the Enlightenment and science and technology and the control over nature and everything else will finally be realized. Several dozen countries have attempted this experiment with American support, in many cases, at least for the Soviet Union, American capital's, you know, private capital support, and they have all failed. Solzhenitsyn is one of the first people to make the claim, as I've made really a centerpiece of this show in my career, that not only is Marxism a Western creation, but the Western world traded with the Soviet Union, gave aid to the Soviet Union, bailed out the Soviet Union. The only reason that the USSR was even created is because of people like Woodrow Wilson and the Food Aid Program and the Red Cross, who went in and made certain that as the Bolsheviks were consolidating power, the famine that the Civil War had created could be alleviated, thereby giving the Bolsheviks a free hand to take over. From that moment onward, trade in technology, machinery, heavy industry, capital, financial advice, financial aid, food aid, especially agricultural products, poured into Russia from the West. There was no Cold War, of course, or at least if there was a war between the Soviet Union and the Western world, it was based not on any antipathy to communism, which certainly did not exist in the American ruling classes in general. It was because the Soviet Union was creating a self-sufficient trading bloc. That was the problem. The fact is that throughout the 50s and 60s, American capitalism traded trillions of dollars with the Soviet Union, not just in trade, but also in direct aid. The Soviet market, Soviet land, Soviet oil, all of this was simply too valuable to be ignored or fought. All of these sectors were developed by Western capital, and the Soviets used this to justify themselves. Now for Solzhenitsyn, all of this ideological talk forgets one thing. That ideology doesn't mean anything unless you have the strength of will and the courage and the virtue to put it into action. That has to come first. And in fact, Solzhenitsyn, Dostoevsky, Aaron, Michael Oakeshott, a lot of these writers hold that political ideology is a way to cover up your own phoniness, your own self-interest, your own bitterness, sense of betrayal, your own jealousy and anger. That ideology is precisely this very simplistic approach to social life that makes you sound intelligent when, in fact, you know, like your average political scientist in the university, you know nothing but the official slogans of the regime and refuse to view society as this incredibly complex organism. Everything can be reduced to machinery. Everything can be reduced to the state. Everything can be ultimately reduced to oligarchy. And oligarchy was the identical form of rule in Moscow, in London, in Washington, D.C., in Peking. It was an oligarchy concerned with production and money and control. Whether or not they justified themselves by pretending to support the working man or pretending to support free markets or pretending to support national self-determination, that didn't make any difference. The state functioned in more or less the same way no matter where you went. How they justified themselves was another matter. You can justify your power through election. But once you're elected, the judges and the bureaucrats and the academics can take over from there. You don't elect bureaucrats. The very proof that the Soviet Union didn't care about working people was the fact that all labor unions were banned. All labor unions were vehemently suppressed as soon as the Soviets took over, because these urban Jews and their hangers-on wanted power, and the fact that they could use this mechanistic, purely economic social theory was simply a convenient weapon and nothing more than that. The only revolution, therefore, is a moral revolution. The only revolution that matters is the reformation, this internal reformation of how we think and how we act. Ideology isn't particularly important. It's how we relate to others on a day-to-day basis and how we survive and how we remain happy, even under the worst of conditions. It's the return to the local, small-scale technology, local communication, local solidarity. That's the sort of testing grounds for our virtue. And people, usually, who spout all of these fake, fashionable ideologies concerning equality or fraternity, usually themselves are vicious individuals who will do anything to take power. They will say anything, they will be anything, they will act, in fact, just like politicians. So simply, you know, these two major 20th century Russian figures are saying very much the same thing, although in very different ways. Aaron is, of course, a metaphysician. His concern is that human beings can only function if they exist according to natural law or logos. Solzhenitsyn tries to take that mentality, which is very, very typical of your Russian Orthodox point of view. Dostoevsky held it and Gogol held it, and show how it works in practical terms, and especially see how the perversion of that to be found in nominalism, to be found in either the Marxist or capitalist definition of man, and how that will destroy and distort everybody that it touches. Nominalism is the great evil. Nominalism, this concept that only the individual exists and only the elite has the right to give it a name and therefore define it and define its purpose and tell you what it is. Nominalism says that there is no intrinsic meaning or purpose to the world. We have to give it. And that is exactly the oligarchic elite point of view that you found in Moscow and Washington, D.C. So although these two writers write in a very different way, ultimately they're saying the exact same thing. And that particular Russian Orthodox philosophical point of view is what which I've dedicated my life to. And it happens to be the truth of the matter. And as Western societies crumble under debt, economic irrationality, the obsession with ego and selfishness, we see that these men were right. No matter what your particular point of view is on these issues, I don't care. The fact is, you can't deny that these systems have failed. And they failed because they misidentified what man, society, and nature really are. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned into